This is KBOO Portland, listener-powered, non-corporate community radio.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. KBOO's Board of Directors meets on the fourth Monday of the month at 6 p.m. This month's meeting will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland and online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting virtually can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
No tenemos que mostrar ningún papel, no tenemos que decirle nada a nadie, menos a la migra, menos a la migra.
From Pacifica Radio in Berkeley, California, at the Mothership, this is Flashpoints. I'm Dennis Bernstein with Miguel Gabriela Molina and Francisco Herrera, our resident troubadour. Today on the show, the American Indian Movement, or AIM, speaks out about arrests of AIM members, indigenous folks, in Minnesota. Lisa Ballinger will be speaking with us from Minneapolis. Also, we'll speak with Richard Montoya, founder of Culture Clash, on new threats to send ICE to L.A. into the schools. And also, Anita Barrows joins us for another reading of her genocide poems from Gaza. All this and more coming up straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned.
No tenemos que mostrar ningún papel. No tenemos que decirle nada a nadie. Menos a la migra. Menos a la migra. Y si la agarran, usted ya sabe qué hacer. Tenemos derecho de mantener silencio. Tenemos derecho de hablarle a un abogado. No tenemos que firmar ni un documento, porque seguro es para la deportación.
And you are listening to Flashpoints at KPFA here in Berkeley, California, coming to you across the country every Friday, or as many Fridays as we can. We have our resident troubadour, Francisco Herrera. Also in the studio is Miguel Gabriela Molina. And listen, there's a lot going on, Gabriela. A lot, huh?
Well, we're dealing with a unconstitutional, lawless, corrupt, almost, mafioso government who has this unbelievable deep hatred and against the brown masses in this country. And when you look at that particular group, the undocumented and refugees, though that's a labor force that I believe constitutes almost 30% of U.S. labor in this country. Yeah. And that labor force does essential work that nobody else wants to do and contribute $1 billion to the economy. So these lies coming out from the fire hose of lies and the arsonist, the madman in the White House, everything that comes out are lies or threats. Yeah. Once we know that and realize that, we're seeing the humanity begin to rise in this country. For a long time, myself, Francisco, and others said, hey, this is going to be a war against us, and I don't think anybody's going to come to help us, to assist us. I was wrong. White America is waking up and going, wait a second. Yeah. This cannot happen in a civil society where freedom and democracy is embraced. So we're preparing for war to get uglier, and we will survive.
Francisco, you're in the streets all the time. Yes. You're working with the folks who are on the front lines, who are being grabbed, threatened, arrested, deported. Yeah. That's your job these days, besides being our troubadour in residence. What are you seeing on the streets? Are people feeling it? Are more people unwilling to go out of their houses? Are more people taking more precautions? What's that?
All of that is true, and I have to say we are all Rene Goods. You know, that is the stand of a woman who loved, who had community as a priority, who has three children, who had a whistle, as her wife said, you know, they have guns.
She was a poet, exactly. An award-winning poet.
She pulled over to help people, and she was actually trying to get out of the way. It's clear to me that guy was under direction. If we look at the School of the Americas torture, book of torture, and
this is a public execution to
create havoc and to create fear. I'm sure that guy was clearly under orders to kill. I mean, that's clear to me. But I have to say that one of the things that's going on that we are doing in a good way as part of supporting this is we're honoring Martin Luther King Jr. this weekend with the Social and Economic Justice Music and Arts Festival. We'll be there. I'll be there with Avacha and Kayla Marin, Jalila Bell, artists, and we're having workshops and trainings on how to use music, how to use the arts in this moment that we
and
have
we're
going to
talk
together.
More about that in one moment. We have our good friend Richard Montoya, founder of Culture Clash, a hero of mine, a long-time friend of our senior producer here, Miguel Gavilán Molina. Richard, things are pretty intense down in your neck of the woods. You want to give us a little background and what you're thinking these days as we see the guy moving towards fascism?
Hey, Dennis.
Welcome.
Compadre Miguel, reporting for duty. can you guys hear me okay?
Simon, go ahead, Richard.
All right, right on. You know, it's I'm driving through a neighborhood to pick up my son right now at his art school. It's a public LAUSD school in an area known as Glassell Park, and there were ICE raids through here yesterday, and the school sent out alerts. They locked the scholars down and then kept parents away. So I find that those sorts of coordinated reactions are absolutely crucial to keeping people from getting disappeared by ICE, which is a daily occurrence here in Los Angeles. A little quieter since Minnesota's getting so much of the focus right now, but nevertheless continuing to happen. And I just learned moments ago of the second death at Fort Bliss Detention Center. You know, our people are being killed. You know, yeah. Brown people are being killed, whether they're on a fishing boat in the Caribbean or on the streets here in the Southwest, and also comrades, allies like Ms. Good up in Minnesota. We never thought we'd get here, Dennis, but here we are. Gavilán used to warn us of moments like this, that fascism was on the rise. I think we always thought, oh, he's, you know, might be a little overreaction, but that's an underreaction now compared to what's actually happening. So things are relatively calm as I speak on a Friday afternoon in Los Angeles. The sun is setting. It seems peaceful, but there's an uneasiness, an unease, calm before the storm as festivals begin to gear up, as sporting events begin to gear up. We're just wondering, we're left to wonder if Stephen Miller's policy of disappearing brown people, will that ratchet up? Will this be the weekend that we get that knock on the door? We just simply don't know. I don't mean to be overly dramatic. It just, there's a great sense of unease and some fear and a lot of anger, man.
And Richard, Francisco here, welcome, hermano. And you guys have actually had schools closing, and that, as well as what we're hearing here in Oakland, is we're losing police that are now being sent or prepared to be sent to L.A. because of this all Olympics thing. So all of a sudden they have money for Olympics, but you guys are actually having to face schools having to close down and things like that, no?
No, they haven't yet, but they're losing students and parents that just don't want to risk being captured. And so school attendance is down. Children are not learning. Children are learning other lessons, life lessons. Mm-hmm. And so it's just a dreadful, dreadful time. But we're also mobilized. We're energized. Senor Bernstein and Gavilan, this is extremely helpful, man. It's almost like life skills that help us navigate these dangerous times.
Well, listen, we know that your phone is on short juice, and but we want to, and maybe you can help us launch this discussion. Gavilan is going to jump in, but we're all being honored by the presence of Alejandro Murguia on Monday. We're doing a special live broadcast,
right.
Obviously, he's a significant player in the mission, in poetry, in the state, and you played a key role in the Other Barrio. Could you just tell us a tale of the Other Barrio? What do you think about it? What do we need to know that we don't know about that part of a beautiful history of the city?
Dennis, thanks for asking. Alejandro, if I just might say, El Gato Murguia is one of the touchstone poets, man. And in 1969, him and my father published a book together, Jose Montoya and Alejandro Murguia. And one half of the book was my dad's. You flip the book over upside down, and then Alejandro's book started on the other side, on the back side. El Espejo, I believe, is the name of the book. A really beautiful collector's edition. And so in 69, these guys were creating these fantastic anthologies. And that I grew up as a kid with that book and have my own copy now. But his short story about the Other Barrio really foreshadowed the greed of the Mission District in the various dot-com bubbles that would come and pop and burst, and then the driving up of rents and properties that really made the Mission out of reach for the working poor. And the way that the developers, there was a rash of fires at that time, that the developers would just simply torch an apartment building, and there were several deaths and people lost their homes, and then those homes removed, and then new lofts, live work lofts, and high end apartments would get built, and we did not know back then that Alejandro foretold in his stories that this would continue to be a problem well into the 2000s, well into the current time, where San Francisco is just simply a town out of reach for working artists and working poor, and he tells that story. It's the first short story novella in his brand new book. I'm happy to say we made a film out of that. It started out as a short film,
right,
with Lou Demetey, Dante Botteo, and Rene Yanez. We made a short film, and then soon we felt that we actually had a feature length film, not a short but a regular feature length film. They allowed me to do some writing on the back end of it. I put Alejandro in the film. I thought it was important that Alejandro, as a voice of the Mission, actually be in the film. And so it's a unique, a quirky little film noir film, completely filmed on the streets of the Mission in San Francisco. And it tells the story of greed and death and the working poor being squeezed and pushed out of San Francisco. And so very proud of the Other Barrio of the film, and that it came from from a beautiful story written by Alejandro, and that you guys are going to honor him, and he's going to honor you, and you're going to be there in the mission on 24th Street, where so much of this happened, all the marches Rene Yanez led, all the anti-gentrification marches, all taking place there on 24th, and I understand that the bookstore is going to be right there in the heart of La Misión. So I'm really, really proud to hear about that. Congratulations.
Thank you. Well, compadre, you know, I read the book, and you know, there's a lot of short stories in it. The recent book, it's a series of short stories of Alejandro's selected, and the book begins with The Other Barrio, and I just got into it. It was as if I was, you know, flying around, you know, overhead and watching the book come to life. And the way you portray the, I believe Roberto was the inspector's name. Was it Roberto?
That's right.
Exactly. And his old flame, which comes back into the picture, Sophia, connected to the actual, basically, orchestrator behind the scenes that caused that to happen. And that individual, the old lady, the old grandmother, who was Latina, you know, is the one that basically, in the story, orchestrated the burning of the hotel and, of course, worked out the deals, you know, the whole construction of development with basically an Irish mafioso. And I just said, wow, you captured certain elements, certain parts of it, even the heat, the passion, the love, the, you know, forgotten love, the refound love, the hopes, the dreams, and the tragedy, all mixed up into one, coming out with hope. And at the end of the story, I just really moved me the way, you know,
don't give it away.
It wraps up the last sentence, I believe, something in the sense of the doña, the old lady, you know, she's old, she won't last too much longer, and at some point she will end up in the other barrio. That just sent shockwaves through me. It was just powerful. And in each story in there has that kind of element where there's love, tragedy, newfound love, reborn love, the despair, the heartbreak of love. It's all, love is in every story. Have you read the book yet, the entire book? Or because I know that exists, in like I said, in the barrio, the story, and the tragedy at the end, where, you know, they take off, they're riding, she has these documents, these archives, these files, and she's showing him in her, you know, sports car, you know, convertible, and they're driving, I think, on Highway 1 near, I believe, Devil's Slide, and, And something happens, and they get off the road. I think a van came by and, like, forced them off the road. And they get off the road, and, you know, they're kind of stuck in the middle of nowhere. And he goes out to get help and puts out his big lighter. And, you know, the fog is so thick in that area that the oncoming driver doesn't see them till the last second. And he steps out of the way, and it hits Sophia in the car, and they go over the cliff.
Right.
All right. Don't tell him any more about it.
It just really moved me.
Well, those are all elements that were really in the writing of Alejandro. And Alejandro and Lou Demetes and Dante Botteo, they allowed me to add some new elements to the story, and one of which is using some anarchists that use the internet to help me battle the colonial ghost of the old lady, for example, the Irish mob guy. These are colonial echoes of colonizers. And it's like people push back on, you know, be very careful, you know, how can Stephen Miller be, you know, a right winger? And I'm like, let me tell you the story of Latin American dictators. It's very easy for Stephen Miller to be a right wing, you know, Nazi thinking secessionists, you know, and that's prevalent in the barrio too. We have people that take advantage of the voiceless, take advantage of poor people, and so that's an old story that's very common. And Stephen Miller is in fact a Confederate and a right wing and, you know, a self-hater. And he's, you know, but, and the other thing that Alejandro allowed me to match wits a bit with him, I had to add some writing to the film part. And my character says to him after he tells me some clues that are going to help me uncover the mysteries of who lit these fires, who killed these people. And he asks me, why am I doing this? And I say to him, because we used to be a city of poets. Mm. And I find that the poets and the artists, we keep losing them. And you can add Berkeley to that. You can add Oakland to that. You can add San Francisco to that. Artists, working poor, simply can't afford to live in the cities anymore. And that's really at the core of these beautiful stories, full of poetry, Alejandro's lyricism, and his humanity as well. You know, it was a time when writers just didn't write fairy tales. You know, they really wrote, and they really carried the torch and the baton for many, many people. And I brush up against writers today that I heard a poet the other day here in L.A., and he claims to be the most political Chicano poet alive. And I said, man, let me tell you about Roberto Vargas, you know, a guy that humped machine guns in La Selva, the mountains of Nicaragua with garrisons and hiking arms to fight fascists in Nicaragua. And the next week you could hear Roberto in a cafe in the Mission, you know, but he was back and forth. Ricardo Sanchez, Raul Salinas, prison poets that ended up in Geneva with American Indian Movement West. These were poets, men and women, that actually put their life, you know, on the lines. And if you're claiming to be the most political poet ever now, and all you're talking is about that I did this and I see this. And my dad was a generation of poets where they took the I out of the movement and it really became a collective we. And I'm missing those times. And you can claim to be political all you want, but I don't know where you stand on Gaza. I don't know where you stand on the West Bank. I don't know where you stand on the IDF. I don't even know where you stand on ICE because you never say it. So these poets. And Alejandro's still a relatively youthful poet, you know. Yeah. He's very vibrant and robust, and I'm really glad he's having his day yet again.
Beautiful. Richard Montoya, Culture Clash, and so much more. Obviously, thank you for taking the time out. We're glad that you
Dennis,
are...
thank you for having me. You're my hero, buddy.
Thank you. Thank you. We all appreciate it.
Thank you, Richard.
We all appreciate you, Richard. Be safe and keep us posted. Keep us posted, okay?
Cuídate. High five the kids.
And you are listening. I think you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. I'm Dennis Bernstein. I'm here with Francisco Herrera. We're going to listen to Francisco, and then we're going to, if all goes well, be joined by Lisa Ballinger. She's a spokesperson for AIM, that's the American Indian Movement, and they are under attack in Minneapolis. That's where AIM is. That's where their battle was in part fought in the early days. Stay with us. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We are having a bit of trouble reaching Lisa Ballinger of the American Indian Movement. Things are very tense on the ground there, and we're doing everything that we can to make that contact. We think it's crucial. Francisco, obviously we're watching something that I never quite saw in my lifetime. In the 70s, and I have seen an awful lot, but the intensity with which Trump is moving forward, and the brevity and the willingness to act very quickly has given us all kinds of new challenges, and really has turned many lives upside down. I'm talking in the millions.
Since Trump came into power here, there's at least 35 people have died in these detention for-profit jails. People have been separated from their families. Folks are being given dirty water in the jails.
Yes.
There's four microwave ovens for 125 people being held. They're being moved from one place to another to make space to get more money, because they get money per bed. So we're seeing official trafficking of human beings for money, for private funds. And we're asking, you were asking about
what's
happening.
Explain that again. So how does that work?
Well, each of these private jails gets, I think, between $300 to $500 per bed that they have filled.
Really?
So to get more people in the bed, they're switching people. A friend of mine's nephew, my co-director, actually, at Nuevo Sol, nephew was caught in, he and his brother were doing mechanic of their house, their car, and they were just kidnapped. And immediately from Corona, California, by L.A., from L.A., the area, they were sent immediately to Albuquerque, to another one of these private jails. Wow. And so they
cashing in each time
with people that they're bringing in. So it's a literally hunting, as the rules for hunting Indians was here just 100 years ago. They were hunting us down and paying 25 cents for a ear, $1.25 here in Oakland.
Yes.
$1.25 for a head of a scalp of a lonely person. And so we're moving in that direction. It's amazing. And what we're doing is getting, or like Miguel was saying, we're getting organized right now. The public execution of our sister Renee Good is something to wake us up, and we're asking people to join the Adopt a Corner campaign to get into Bay Resistance, National Alerts, and continue. And now we're going to hear from our sister in Minneapolis.
Beautiful. And we're going to, that's really important information, Francisco Guerrero on Flashpoints, Pacifica Radio. We're now joined by Lisa Ballinger. She is a spokesperson for AIM, that's the American Indian Movement. And Lisa Ballinger, welcome to Flashpoints. I think you're in Minneapolis now. Where are you?
Correct. I'm going to try and...
All right, give us, if you could run down the kinds of encounters and what you're dealing with in terms of ICE and the indigenous communities. We know that there's a lot going on at a lot of different levels. Tell us everything you can. We want to know.
Okay. First of all, thank you for paying attention and calling in and being... in that way to honor and recognize our indigenous involvement in this. I'm with AIM. I've been with AIM since it started. My mom was part of the first St. Paul AIM office here, Pat Bellinger, and worked with Clyde in developing AIM in the Twin Cities here, and Eddie Benton Benet and a few other of our late greats who are no longer with us. And one of the things that we started here in Minneapolis was AIM Patrol. And basically it was a community effort at monitoring and documenting and bearing witness to the cruel interactions between police and our people. And so this AIM Patrol has been, we have called on, have brought it you know, I had to resurge it again, regather and again over the years for different activities. We had in the 80s, we're dealing with a serial killer of American Indian women, of our people. And then again, in of course, with the George Floyd riots, the day after Uncle Clyde announced or made his press statement announcing me as a new director for the AIM Interpretive Center here in Minneapolis and chair for our, putting me in place for our grand governing council of all of our AIM chapters. The next day George Floyd was killed, and again we were boots on the ground, you know, like I came out of the chute right there again. And so we launched AIM Patrol, got it back up again. And but you know, we've been present all along. We've had an interpretive center here and such, and you know, have been an integral part of the community, providing a New Year's Eve sobriety event for over 30 years. And so, we've hosted different powwows and community events. So as the events took place here with the killing of Renee Good, of course we had to, you know, we have been doing AIM Patrol pretty much steady since the riots. You know, we kept it up and we focused on community, or keeping our community corridor safe. And in the event there was a protest march that comes towards our spaces, our organization buildings and spaces and living areas, we work to deflect those protest marches out of our community, you know, and really make that focus. So with the recent riots, you know, or the with the killing of Renee, you know, ICE was becoming a big issue here, and it was an occasional, we would see it on Facebook, or we would hear about, you know, somebody getting picked up from ICE, a tribal person around, you know, the area, the region. But after Renee Good, it really, you know, it really kicked up. You've seen it on the social media. And as an indigenous person here, you know, from our tribal nations, we are experiencing, you know, the same, you know, they can't tell whether we're indigenous from the north or indigenous from the south. They cannot tell who is an enrolled tribal member and who is not. And so, you know, we face the same threats as all of our indigenous relatives that are in the area here. And so we had a campaign, you know, like what is, we have the Know Your Rights cards that we start getting those out right off the bat. We got, with my partner, we have a community partner, a national partner in out of D.C., the Rural Coalition. And I called them up. I said, well, I need some Know Your Rights cards now. So they sent some cards over to the printers here locally so that we could get them the next day. And they sent some more from a national Know Your Rights place that's doing the red cards. We got them in English and Spanish. We got them in English and Somali because we have a lot of Somali partners in our community. So we started with the Know Your Rights stuff, and you know, the Know Your Rights stuff only works in, you know, if they're going to listen, right? They have to respond and listen, but they don't listen. They just grab, they act, and it is, you know, it's terroristic. Gee, and they call us terroristic. So we've had tribal people detained, picked up, detained. Some have been let go.
How have they been treated when they're picked up? What do people say to them? Are any still in custody now? As much as you could tell us about the way they're treated, and if you're concerned that this is part of an expanding operation.
Well, yeah, they sent in more. They promised another 2,000 people. There's an impending white supremacist march that's supposed to happen tomorrow afternoon. You know, so they're flooding. They're coming to Minnesota in droves. And in here in Minnesota, there's a journalist who was posting. I was reading her story, and she said she applied just to see what it was like and what was the process and what you would have to go through to become an ICE agent. And she said they hired her without even no background check. So that just tells you, they're just pulling people, anybody, and there's talk and people are posting that, there's members of Proud Boys and those kind of organizations, similar organizations that are coming as ICE agents, have joined the ranks. But again, as a Native person and an Indigenous person here from the North, we have unique rights. We have the regular Know Your Rights cards, but it's like, hey, wait a minute, we have added protections of being enrolled members of federally recognized tribes. And so Indian Collective came on scene, and they brought in the chairman of Frank Starr, comes out from Pine Ridge, the Oglala Sioux tribe chairman. He put out a statement, and in that statement he had very specific wordage for his tribal members. If you get picked up by ICE, you say, I am a member of the Oglala Sioux tribe, and under such and such treaty, we have protection and we have sovereignty. And so he created this statement for people to read. It was kind of lengthy, so Indian Collective condensed and put the key statement pieces. I am an enrolled member of blank tribe. I am, as a tribal member, I have rights I have treaty rights, and I am a member of a sovereign nation. So we have those cards for people to read, and so it helps to recognize that. But in the last 2 days, they asked for ID, and then people have been putting, sending us like a conference ID badge holders that you wear around your neck with a lanyard and say, put your tribal ID in there. You don't have time to dig for your purse if they grab you. You don't have time to look in your car. Have your tribal ID on you so that if you get separated from your purse or your wallet or wherever your bag where you have your tribal ID, it is on you. So we've been telling folks, we're passing these ID badges out. Tribes have come to Minneapolis to do tribal ID cards, and that is a process. Let me tell you, there's some tribes that have urban offices from Minnesota here that have ID makers on site, and they've been like pushing them out left and right for their tribal members. And you cannot go, if I'm a member of the Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe, I cannot go to the Mille Lacs Band of Ojibwe and get an ID card from them. I have to go to my specific tribe to get that tribal ID. And so our tribal ID enrollment office came down and was here for 2 days. And they were swamped.
It sounds like, it really sounds like the whole ID system is a setup for failure. And a lot of people are not going to be able to be responding in ways that protect themselves. We're just about out of time, but I do want to ask you, are there people that you know of that you're dealing with, that your tribe is dealing with, who are in custody, who have been mistreated? Is there anything that we should understand about the actual physical treatment of people by ICE?
Right. From what we know with the guys that got out, like the four Oglala who Chairman Star comes out, they got one out, was released. Nobody's really spoke of the treatment, although they're getting transferred around. And they said they were going to hold the other three until Pine Ridge or Oglala Sioux Tribe signed an agreement with immigration. Mm. They're trying to utilize to hold these three men hostage. And the other thing about the tribal IDs is, people are going to all lengths to try and get their tribal IDs. But now what they're doing is they'll ask for your ID, and then if you have a tribal ID, they'll ask for it, and then they'll say, who's your tribal chairman? And then they'll Google it, to make sure you're who you say you are. Wow. But they have started to keep those tribal IDs. So that's an issue because those are...
How many generations, how many tens of thousands of years have your people lived? How many treaties, broken treaties, torn, ripped up, shredded treaties? This really, in a terrible way, this sounds like a continuation of that kind of abuse and disrespect of indigenous communities who were first on the earth here. We're going to leave it there now, Lisa Ballinger of American Indian Movement, but we thank you very much for taking the time out, and we hope we can check back with you and see what's going on the ground in your communities. So thank you.
Yes, anytime. I'm honored.
Thank you. We're honored to have you. And you are listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We are going to take a musical break now, and then we're going to have our poetry reading.
When you clearly see the stars, and as you sleep and rest, baby, your body grows strong and wise. Atrévete a soñar. Atrévete a soñar que un día libre serás.
President. Our resident troubadour, Francisco Arreta. Francisco, we thank you for your service tonight. The music is always crucial. And we're about to do poetry, but what I like to say, Francisco, is there are many, many ways to get information. And of course, we do the news, and we're on the front line, and we're talking to people. But it comes through the poetry, and it comes through the music, and I think that people count on the music and the poetry as a context and a cushion and a way to understand things that are sometimes absolutely incomprehensible, at least to some of us who can't believe that how willing people are to hurt other people for essentially structural financial gain. It really is out of control. So we thank you, Francisco.
Yeah, and thank you.
I know you're dealing with some stuff, so we're going to say goodbye to you, and we're going to welcome So I'm showing you the door, man.
Bienvenida, Anita.
Ciao, Francisco. Good to see you.
And it's good to see you, Anita. And for those of you who do not know, as we let Francisco go, you're going to hear a few little noises, squeaks, doors, stuff like that. But we're informal here. Anita has written a poem, a powerful poem, for every day of the genocide. Can you get that? And we've had the honor here at Flashpoints to collaborate with Anita and provide a platform for this extraordinary flow of poetry. And again, poetry as crucial information, right?
Absolutely.
That comes to you. It's sort of, I think of it sometimes, it's sort of, it skips the mind, it starts in the heart,
mm-hmm.
you know, works its way through the blood system. And then you get the information too, and the meaning.
Right.
So tell us, by the way, Anita has been a marvelous translator of Rilke, many of her own books. She's got a new book coming out. We'll tell you about that in a moment. But tell us about why you're doing this, and then read. Do you have today's poem?
I do, yeah.
Okay, why don't you tell us a little bit about what this has meant to you? And are those headphones okay?
They're kind of falling off my head.
They're driving you crazy.
But they're okay.
Pull down like that.
Like that?
Yeah.
Or up. Yeah. They'll work. It's okay, as long as the mic works.
It does. Yeah. I hear you.
Great. So I began when the genocide began because I felt like I had to do something. And, you know, being here, I was at my wit's end for what I could do. But I said to myself, all right, I can write poetry. And the stories that were coming out at the beginning and that keep coming out, we are now at day 833, were so harrowing. And mostly I have been drawn to the stories of the children in Gaza. I work with children here. I do psychotherapy with kids, traumatized kids, kids with developmental issues. And so children are really my biggest focus. And I found what was happening to the children there unconscionable, unbearable. And I felt like I just had to keep writing about it. In the process, I joined a group called We Are Not Numbers, which is an organization founded by some people in Gaza, including Rifat Al-Arir, who was assassinated in December of 2023. He was a wonderful poet. I have one of the poems I brought is about him. But it was founded to pair young people in Gaza who are writing in English in order to have access to the wider world with writers who write in English. And so I've got three students there whom I'm in constant touch with, and they're extraordinary writers and extraordinary young people. So good things have come from that, and a sense that I can actually be present to them in some way that matters.
Yeah. Well, why don't you read today's...
Great.
...the poem for what day is this?
833. Yeah.
Mm.
And some of you who may have heard my daughter Nora's report yesterday heard the fact that since the ceasefire began, at least one child every day has been killed, the number of children
since
killed.
Since the ceasefire.
Since the ceasefire, so-called, began. Day 833. Since what they call a ceasefire, a child has been killed every day. Every day, one child less. Count them. Now subtract one and one and one. Bomb, sniper, freezing cold. A child's game, rock, scissors, paper, rock, break, scissors, paper covers rock, scissors cut paper, cut, break, cover, bomb kills more, sniper gets you in the head, in the eye, in the groin, cold covers everything, everyone. In a month, a whole kindergarten of children dead. In 2 months, an entire grade, a child each day, a child who was someone's world, your child, whose small arms, silken hair, you'll never touch again.
A child who was someone's world.
Exactly.
A child who was someone's
was
world.
Someone's
Remember
world.
That. See, that's the thing about poetry. We all know and can feel that. We know what it means for a child to be our world, the kind of joy and celebration that can go along with childhood and being there as the adult, being lucky enough to be a part of an uninterrupted sharing and growing. But instead, it's this horrible thing that's happening that continues to happen. By the way, we're speaking with a good friend of our show, Anita Barrows. She's a wonderful poet. She's the mom for Nora Barrows Friedman, speaking of mothers and kids. You are going to be, you've got a new book, and you're going to be reading these poems.
I am. I'm going to be reading.
I hear.
Yeah, with you, Dennis. I'm going to be reading some poems from this collection of Gaza poems, which are published on a website that Nora made for me, poemsforgaza.com. But I'm also going to be reading some poems from my book, which was published this past fall, called Some Figs. And some of them are about Palestine as well.
And is there any place where people can see you in the near future?
There is, with you. Dennis and I are reading together, not in chorus, but, you know, one after the next. On Tuesday, the 20th, that's this coming Tuesday, the day after Martin Luther King Day, at Pegasus Books on Solano Avenue. It's the first block of Solano between the Alameda and Colusa at 6:30 p.m. So Dennis is going to be reading from his work, past and present.
And I'm going to be reading about the children that I wrote about in when I was a special ed teacher. I've been thinking a lot about these kids. They've really been in my dreams ever since this genocide, this version of the genocide unfolded. And there, I just hear, you know, I'll read you one or two, but I just hear them. This is called Paulie's Bouncing Bible. He carried his basketball wherever he went. Sometimes he bounced it fiercely and took aim at hoops that only he could see. Sometimes he twirled it on one finger like a bulbous ballerina. But mostly Paulie held the ball between his palms, against his chest, the way a preacher holds a Bible to make God's point. Just like his mother's little Christ, it strengthened his grip on things, extended his palms around a world he was barely able to hold on to. That's Paulie's Bouncing Bible. And how about this is called Slamming the Door on Christmas, I guess, since we just celebrated so-called Christmas, whatever that means. So this is called Slamming the Door on Christmas. There's about 50 minutes left until Christmas recess. We are heading for the gym. That's when Kiki calls out to Luce in Miss Klein's class just as we're passing by in the hallway. Miss Klein slams shut the door while two of Kiki's fingers are still in the door jam. Her flesh is crushed easily between sharpened edges of oak and steel. The door is locked. I am banging on the window, vying for the teacher's attention. Kiki is jumping up and down and crying for me or God or her mother or someone to help her. I smash my fist through the door window and unlock it with a handful of glass. I am standing there with my arms around Kiki, surrounded by screaming kids, both of us bleeding into the shards.
Oh, my God, Dennis. Wow.
See, these are real stories.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah,
am exactly. I reporting?
Right.
Is this a poem? Believe me, I took that kid to a civil rights lawyer, and we got some justice. It makes me cry to think about it. But, you know, who is protecting these kids in Gaza?
Oh, God. Exactly. Exactly.
I guess one more little one here. I don't know how we're doing on time. Okay, I'm going to leave it for you. By the way, I'm honored to be able to be there with you and honor the work you're doing. And it's been such an extraordinary inspiration to have you along on this ride as we deal with what we're dealing with.
I want to say the same to you, Dennis. It has meant so much to me to be able to send you these poems every day and for you to read them and call me and say, can you read this afternoon? It is wonderful.
Okay, well, you know what? I'm giving you the rest of the time. We have about 3.5 minutes. Please.
Okay. This is day 825 about a child. Her name was Hamza Husu, and she was 11 years old. Her small feet protrude from the stiff blanket on the steel table at the morgue at Shifa Hospital. She's still wearing the striped pajamas she went to bed in last night. They were in what was called the safe zone. Safe from what? From whom? At 5 in the morning in this new year, nearly 90 days into what they call a ceasefire, Hamza Husu was asleep, and suddenly she was dead. Her small face covered in blood, her striped pajamas covered in blood, her bed sheets covered in blood. Now she will never go back to school. Now she will never finish reading the book she was reading before she slept. Now she will never wait again for her uncle to come home with lentils, oranges. Now she is not a child anymore, but one more name we must never forget. This is day 830, earlier this week, and this is for Dr. Rifat Al-Adir, whom I mentioned before. At last they have placed a headstone on Rifat's grave with lines from one of his poems. If I must die, let it bring hope, let it bring a tale. Can his small daughter, the one who was starting to love to read, can she visit her father's grave with her mother and tell him about the book she's reading, the stories she's writing? Has his death brought her anything but sorrow, anger, unending loss? It's a tale. A tale so many of us are telling now with Rifat, our guide, our mentor, our inspiration, our issuer of orders. If I must die, he said, you must live to tell my story. We are living, Rifat, to tell your story, yours and hundreds of thousands of others. We are living to make sure the stories don't die. The stories, Rifat, are the ground, the foundation, the place where rebuilding begins. Your gravestone, Rifat, rising from the soft earth above so many who have no stones, whose stories we can only guess.
Wow. Well, that's Anita Barrows, and my name is Dennis Bernstein. The show is Flashpoints. Anita has been writing a poem every day of the genocide. Final words. We don't have any more time.
No more time.
People can come meet you in person.
Thank you, Dennis. Come to the reading and you'll hear more from both of us.
Thank you. And you're listening to Flashpoints.
And that does it for another episode of Flashpoints. Our executive producer is Dennis Bernstein. Senior producers are Miguel Gavilan Molina and Kevin Pina. Technical director is Mike Biggs. Our theme music is written and produced by Charlie Lang. For questions, comments, email Dennis Bernstein at dennis@kpfa.org. Thank you for listening.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
New year, new KBOO. Thank you to everyone who contributed and supported us during our KBOO Fights Back end of year campaign.